The closest I could ever get to like being in water in prison was when I would do my laundry. I would put both hands in the washer and splash around like an idiot. And when I first came home, the first place we went to, 4th of July, I went to Lake Paris. And I did not care how green that water was. I got right in it and dove right in and did a flip in that water because I was so excited to be swimming again.
That's the voice of Kimberly Long. We've just been walking by the harbour entrance at Seaport Village in downtown San Diego. You can hear the boats leaving the harbour, people out having fun on jet skis, and the helicopters going to the nearby naval base. Kim was convicted of the murder of her long-term boyfriend, Oswaldo Conde. She served 7 years of a life sentence wrongly received. Kim was failed by the police investigating the crime, and later by her own attorney, who missed clear evidence that proved she couldn't have been the one who killed Oswaldo. We started by talking about her childhood and first meeting Ozzy.
So we grew up in Orange County, where Knott's Berry Farm and Disneyland was, and I had pretty much a normal childhood, just going through elementary school and junior high, and just the same basic issues and, you know, stories everybody else would have. I was in band. I was really musically talented. I could pretty much pick up any instrument and play it. So I loved band, but that was all in elementary school. Once I got to junior high, you know, things change. But I had a lot of friends, hung out. Back in that day, you played outside. We didn't have electronics or anything like that. I think Atari came out, but we didn't really mess around with stuff like that. So just played outside like any other normal kid. You know, I met Ozzy when I was about 11 or 12 years old. I was ditching school because junior high was rough. I've said it before, y'all, I was bullied pretty bad in junior high. And so I didn't want to go to school. So I was ditching school and I met Ozzy at a park when we were just kids. Of course, he was ditching school too. So I knew him for a really long time. But back in 2003, I was just separated from my husband. And I was going out to see my aunt in LA, and I decided to stop by and see if Ozzy still lived in the same house. And I showed up and he was standing outside, and that's how we met all over again. You know, I was a nurse, I had two kids. They were 5 and 10, and I was 27 years old. And that's like when everything all started, right in that moment. So we decided the night before on Saturday to go for a motorcycle ride on Sunday. Ozzy had just bought a Honda, which I always say I was upset about because I would rather have a Harley. So we got together about 10, 11 o'clock and we went out. I think it was Ozzy, me, and about 3 or 4 other friends on their motorcycles and wives. And we rode around to a bunch of different bars, listened to music, and that's how our day was starting out.
Kim and Ozzy got into a typical drunken spat, which was witnessed by their common friend Jeff Dills. She stayed with Jeff until he dropped her off. Now, Jeff said this was around 1:30 a.m., whereas Kim claimed it was after 2 a.m. That would be seen as vital evidence, as the 911 call wasn't made until around 10 past 2 in the morning. Jeff would die before trial, meaning his single, unchallenged testimony would go some way to getting Kim convicted. As with many cases, the police would come to blame the person who found the victim. In this case, that was Kim, who walked into their home and found Ozzy's body bludgeoned in what appeared to be an aggressive and violent attack. Tunnel vision meant that the investigators would miss key evidence that negated Jeff's testimony. For instance, a time of death expert would have proven she was out at the time of the attack, and that she was wearing exactly the same clothes that the police later found her wearing. Kim and her clothes had no traces of Ozzy's blood on them, in spite of a messy and violent murder scene.
Walked over, I turned on the light, and when I turned around to look at him, the first thing I saw was a big red blood stain on the arm of the couch. And then I looked up at him and his face was swollen. His face was swollen and black and bruised, and there was blood. And I went over to him and I called his name and I looked at him. And I knew in that very moment what I saw, I could not help. And I don't know if you're not there, I guess you'll never understand that. But being a nurse at the time, there was nothing I could do. He wasn't waking up, nothing was going on. So I went and I ran outside to see if I could catch Jeff for some reason because he was riding away. I came back in and I called 911. And they didn't come soon enough. I called 911 again and they asked me if I could help him. And for some reason in that split moment, I feel like I kind of came to, and I yelled at them that I was a nurse. And I remember I unzipped my coat, I took it off, and I went over to him and I grabbed him by his hand and I tried to pull him up to arouse him, because there's no reason why he shouldn't have woken up. There's no reason why he should be dead on my couch, you know? And once I pulled on his arm, he made a noise that came out of his mouth and blood came out of his mouth, and I screamed. And I ran outside, and at that time, every cop in Corona showed up, every ambulance, every fire truck. The whole street was lit up at that point, and that was it. They tried to get me into a police car and I was freaking out, and I freaked out worse once the ambulance came back out of my house without him on the gurney. And that's when I knew that that he was just most likely dead at that point.
And that's the love of your life, right?
It was. I was the first person that I ever loved. I mean, I was a kid, so who knows, does an 11 or 12 year old know really what love is? I don't know, but all I know is Ozzy was the love of my life. That's how I felt, and I still feel that way today. You know, I knew him since I was a little girl. We didn't have any enemies. He never had an enemy. He was a good person. And it just did not make sense what was going on in my house that night. I worked in the emergency room, so I knew all the cops. They would always come in and bring their, you know, suspects or whoever in, and I was always removing tasers from people. So I had a relationship with the Corona Police Department. So I thought I was helping by speaking to them anytime they asked me to talk to them, anytime they would call, anytime they wanted to interview me. But I had realized within 3 days that, actually within 24 hours, that they were possibly against me. Yeah, they did not look for anybody else. It was just me. After they interviewed me for 3 hours and screamed and yelled at me, I knew right then and there that they said that we believe you did it. And that was it. That was 3 days after he was murdered. That was October 9th. You know, I figured once they did some more investigation that they would realize it wasn't me. I mean, I woke up every morning sick to my stomach, but knowing something was gonna come out of this. There's no way I'm gonna be arrested for this. They're just not looking yet. This is their tactic. I've never been arrested before. I had a DUI when I was 19 years old. I'm not in trouble with the law. I don't do anything that I've been arrested for. I don't have a negative, you know, rapport with the law. So it really confused me when they just kept picking on me, picking on me, picking on me. I did not ever believe that I would be arrested for this. I trusted the Corona Police Department up to the very end when I was arrested in front of my son. I believed and I trusted in them. And that's one of my biggest regrets, is ever speaking to the police. That's the one regret I have today. I should have never spoken to him. And I'll never call the cops to this day, ever. I don't feel the cops are on my side. I have a whole different outlook on police, which is unfortunate, you know, because I feel like I'm on my own. If I'm getting robbed, then I just got robbed. There's nothing I could do about it.
What did you say to your son when you were getting arrested?
He was 5 years old, and the cops asked me to come down. They have a police lineup they want to show me, and I told them I'm taking my son to kindergarten. They said, oh, just take a second. We'll meet you at McDonald's real quick. And so I did. I went down with my son, and they pulled up. They asked me to come get out of the car, and I got out of the car, and he had a book in his hand, and when I came around the corner, another cop pulled up behind my car, and the officer grabbed me and said, you're being arrested, Long, for first-degree murder. And I heard my son screaming in the car. He's five, and two big officers are grabbing his mother. And that makes me angry, talking about that. It hurts me really bad that they did that, knowing I was gonna have my son with me. I never got to explain it to my son what happened. I wasn't allowed to speak to my children about this case at all or what was going on in my life because they would be taken from me by their dads. So I never once got to explain anything until I came home from prison 2 years ago. I got to explain to my 18-year-old son what was going on in my life.
And this is still an ongoing process, so this is 15 years, more than 15 years.
Yeah. More than 15 years later, I'm still going through all this, and so are my kids. They were 5 and 10, and now they're 20 and 25. I was 27 years old, and I am now 42. I knew they were coming back with the guilty verdict because there's too many officers in the courtroom. I knew it. I felt it. It was December 27th, 2 days after Christmas. And once we got in there and they said I was guilty, I turned around and I looked back at my dad. And I think seeing my dad's face and the look of defeat, that's what got me the most, was seeing my father. And I had to get strong really quick, really quick. And I had to put on a brave face for my family, and I had to suck it up that day. Judge Majors was the judge that heard both of my trials, and you know, he's a man of integrity, and I just believe that to this very minute today. And he said, you know, Miss Long, if this was a trial by court, which meant, you know, my trial being heard before a judge and not my jury, he said, I would have found you not guilty. And he sentenced me to 15 to life and then gave me bail. And I bailed out that same day with a 15 to life conviction and tried my best to get on with my life. We were waiting for the appellate court to make their decision because, of course, it was appealed. And I did that from 2006 until 2009. For 3 years, I tried to live my life. And it was actually like the worst, probably 3 years of my life. It was the worst 3 years of my life.
Kim was then faced with an unimaginable dilemma. Do you hand yourself into a life sentence and risk never seeing your kids again? At first, she found that a difficult thing to do.
How do you turn yourself into a life sentence? I want to meet somebody who's able to walk in, which I actually did. It just took me an extra few days to wrap my head around it. How do you give up everything? How do you give up your nursing? How do you give up your children? How do you give up your family? How do you give up your life to go in to a prison forever?
Yeah, voluntarily.
Yeah, voluntarily. And I did. I've turned myself in twice already. I had to turn myself in once before when my bail ran out before my first hearing, and I did it again. With no certainty that I would ever come home, I turned myself in.
Can we touch on your time in prison? For anyone listening on the outside, it's so difficult to even fathom what prison's like, what every day is like, how bad it is, how maybe you made really close friendships, for instance. Mm-hmm. Just could you describe what your time was like inside?
You know, I know a lot of other exonerees, and most of them are men, and their time is different than women's, I have to say. You know, we're not segregated. My time was very hard in the beginning. I learned a lot of lessons, and I had to adapt, and it took me about 3 years to really adapt to prison. I didn't know anybody. I didn't have any street cred. I wasn't in a gang, and I wasn't in the dope scene. So I didn't know anybody when I got in there, pretty much. So it was very hard for me to figure out how to get into the mindset of prison when you don't know what that is. So that's why it took me some extra time. But, you know, it's almost like you sink or swim. You're gonna adapt or you're gonna die, you know? And you know, human beings will accept their situation and adapt for survival. And that's exactly what I did. I didn't accept the fact that, I never accepted the fact that I'd be there for life, but I had to accept the fact that I was there for that day. And I lived each day as if I was going home. So, you know, I got into the swing of things, and I did meet a bunch of good women in there. The women I met in there, I'm still friends with today. The girls that I know came home, and we hike, and we go places, and we ride our motorcycles together. And there were some really strong and loyal friendships. But there was times in prison where, you know, it was absolutely horrible. You know, you can't control anything that's going on at home, and you're trying to find your purpose. You're trying to find your purpose when you're in prison, and then you try to find it when you come home years later. But it was a difficult trek. There was times where I would just face the wall and cry. I gave up once for a few hours, and that felt pretty bad. So then I got back on board, and I tried to be strong. But, you know, you put on a brave face when your family comes to visit you. And then when they leave, you know, when you're having to strip out to go back to your prison cell, this might sound bad, but when you're stripped out and you're naked and the guard leaves, you're so vulnerable in that moment. Just standing there, just violated, but you just got to see your family, which was awesome. But when they leave, you cry. I remember many times just standing there in that holding tank, just crying, trying to put my clothes back on and muster up the strength to get back on that prison yard and get to my cell. And those were horrible times. Those were probably the worst times, is when I watched my family walk out of visiting. Always giving them a pep talk that this will be the last year. This will be the last year. That's hard. That was really hard.
Seeing your kids and your family is something that's, you feel like you're missing out, I'm guessing, on their life. I mean,
yeah, I think the worst part is hearing about it once you come home. You know, when you're driving past this just happened. I was driving past my son's school. My whole family was in the car, and they spoke about how my son said, oh, I used to ride my skateboard home from here, or grandma would pick me up, and like, I don't know anything about that. You know, I didn't even know what high school he went to. You know, I wasn't privy to all that, you know? I was so busy in prison trying to get out of there, you know, that I didn't ask those questions, and sometimes I didn't focus on them. But that's the hardest part, is knowing that 7 years happened and I don't know any of it. I wasn't there for my son's first heartache. I wasn't there for my daughter's prom. I wasn't there for anybody's graduation. Nobody's, you know, but I did make it home for my daughter's wedding.
Contacting CIP, contacting California Innocence Project. When was the moment that you realized they were looking into your case and they were on your side?
They took my case in 2010, and that was one of the best moments, knowing that there was somebody besides my parents with a little bit more clout fighting behind me. That made me feel amazing, and it really helped me with my time in prison. I had the same people throughout two trials, which means I had the same judge, same DA, and the same attorney. And what was never brought up was my clothes and what I was wearing that night. They had no blood on them, and the DA's star witness said exactly what I was wearing. And I just don't understand why that was never brought in. I just don't get it. It drives me crazy. And so that was one of the main things. I finally asked the CIP, one of the students, I was like, did you find the tape? Did you find the tape of Jeff Dill saying exactly what I wore? And he did. He actually went and he actually found it. And that meant everything. So I'm thinking, oh my gosh, this tape doesn't exist anymore. I can't believe this is happening to me. But that for me, that I felt like that's all I needed. That's all I needed. And it's funny because once I got into my evidentiary hearing, not to jump forward, but the judge even said I wasn't privy to this information. Once again, the same judge, both trials, came for my evidentiary hearing. He said I was not privy to this information. I don't understand. The DA had the tape. Just doesn't make any sense. If there's any doubt I could possibly be not guilty, then why are you messing with me? Why are you messing with me? Of course, we finally had a time of death expert, and they said there was no way that he was alive after midnight. And, you know, I forgot what the DA was saying. It was those 5 days of evidentiary hearing, I almost remember nothing. But, I mean, of course, I think everything that was brought in the first two trials should have set me free anyways. It just doesn't make any sense to me. For me, it was just all about the clothes. Right there, for me, that just shows me right there. That should show anybody that I didn't commit this crime when there's not a drop of blood on my clothes, on my hair, on my persons, nowhere.
Let's talk about that day that the judge orders a retrial.
Well, I thought he was gonna say certain words, you know, that meant I was going home or something. I'm not sure. A reversal. I think I was waiting for the word reversal. I think he said vacated, and that wasn't reversal to me. And so I just sat there because I didn't know what was happening, but my attorney kept squeezing my leg every time something was positive. And then she really kept squeezing my leg, and I'm like, I don't get it. I don't understand. And I mean, you know, I'm sitting there and I can't breathe. I'm hyperventilating like inside my head. Because this is the moment, whether I'm going to be set free or not, this is the moment. Am I going back to prison or am I going home today? Am I sleeping in a real bed or back to a cot? Like, I was just so crazy in that moment. But once I realized, like, that was it, like, it's going to be reversed. I mean, that was a moment, don't get me wrong. But what I really wanted to know is if I was going to get bail, if you're going to put an ankle monitor on me. Am I walking out those doors? That's all I wanted to know, is if I was gonna walk out those doors. And when the judge said he was gonna grant bail, I had everybody in the courtroom ready to give up money. Everybody in the courtroom was like, we'll pay, you know? And I looked back at my dad and I told him, I said, I'm gonna be home for Father's Day. I'm gonna be home for Father's Day.
And then you did walk out, and
I still didn't believe it. I still didn't believe it after they gave me some clothes to wear and stuff. I still didn't believe it. I'm like, nope, I'm gonna walk out and they're gonna snatch me. They gave me really tall shoes and I had to practice walking in them in the holding tank. I did. I didn't know.
Because you hadn't walked in heels, I'm guessing,
for 7 years, 3 months. Yeah. Yeah, they gave me these tall shoes and I had tight pants. It was strange. And I had to walk back and forth, and it was pretty cool. I walked back and forth for a long time in that holding tank, and they didn't let me out until 10 o'clock that night. But once I walked out those doors, everybody stared at me. Nobody said anything. I didn't know what to do. So I just yelled, I made it. I didn't know what else to say. I made it. And yeah, I got to hug my mom and dad for as long as I wanted. There was no time limit on when, how long I could hug my mom and dad that day.
My name is Michael Simanchik, and I'm the managing attorney at the California Innocence Project. Through my work, I have seen both the devastation of a wrongful conviction and the joy of being able to walk somebody free after many years in prison. But this work comes at a price, and we rely on donations from the public. Please help out in any way you can by visiting CaliforniaInnocenceProject.org.
I woke up the next day. I didn't go to bed till like 2 a.m. I woke up the next day and I had coffee with my dad. And he goes, come on, let's go for a car ride. I want to show you Corona. And the funniest thing is that the first place he took me, I'm so mad to this day because I'm already car sick in the car. He takes me back to the prison. He takes me to the front of the prison. He goes, I just thought you'd make, you know, you might want to see what it looks like from this side. And I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe you did this to me. So he takes me to the front of the prison and I feel like I'm ducking in the car for some reason. My dad's a sick man. So he drove me around and I was car sick, but it was actually a really good time. But reconnecting with my family was very difficult. I was a bit of a different person coming home. I was a little bit more, my mom says I was a little bit more harder. And I needed to, it took me a second to get rid of all that. It took me a good year to get rid of maybe a bit of an attitude maybe. My kids, there was an awkwardness between us, which shouldn't have been there, which made it more frustrating for us all. That's gone. And you know, I've been home for over 2 years, but it took a good year for everything to slightly go back to some type of normalcy. I was trying to find my purpose in their lives, you know? And I've said this before, you know, there's no more getting ready for school. I don't have to wake anybody up. I'm not making anybody breakfast, dinner. I'm not taking anybody to soccer practice. There's no birthday parties. I mean, all that is gone. And what is my purpose? I didn't have a purpose and I was trying to find it. And that was really hard to do. It took me a long time, but you know, but I did, you know? So kind of reintegrating back into my family's life, into my friend's life, was a bit of a challenge. Even my friend Joanna, I left, she had motorcycles. I come back, she has strollers. I'm like, what happened to the motorcycles? You know, they traded them in for two kids, you know, it was strange. So I missed out on quite a bit. So it takes a minute to get into the swing of things. Everything is just amazing to me. Everything, like I see life through like a new pair of glasses. You know, the water, the beach, sea-doos, there's boats roaming around everywhere, motorcycles, just people, food, you know, ice and real glasses, you know, straws, which I don't use anymore because of the sea turtles. Okay, it's another story, but you know, what was the question?
Life now
is awesome. There's been some setbacks, but for the most part, you know, I'm involved in anything and everything. For the first 2 years, I ran pretty hard. Like in sixth gear, I was just going for it. I'm starting to settle down a little bit. I feel like I missed out on a lot. And so I made up for it. But, you know, I'm back in school. I'm getting my business degree. I just graduated from dog grooming school. I would like to have my own business. I work now in a mobile unit. I give back. I'm a mentor to a lot of girls. We all go to certain meetings. And so I mentor a lot of women. I have a lot of commitments. I'm very active in my community. And, you know, I do a lot with my mom and dad. I run with my dad. I hike with my dad. Poor guy. I feel bad for him that he retired because now I'm taking him up these horrible hikes, you know, but he's doing it. 12 miles he just did a couple days ago, you know, and I just have wonderful times with my mom. Every part of my life is like super busy. And I'm loving every bit of it. I'm engaged, I wanna be married. You know, my son lives with me so I can hear him in the next room at night, sometimes midnight when he comes home, but I can hear him scurrying around in there. And there's something about that. There's something about knowing my son is in the next room or watching him come down the stairs in the morning that if you haven't done time and missed out on that, you wouldn't understand what that looks like or what that feels like to a mother. And I love those moments. I absolutely love those moments. So right now, like I said, there's some difficulties with, you know, being arrested and trying to get jobs and all that, but I'm not one to lay down and curl up, you know? I'll just find an avenue around it. The closest I could ever get to like being in water in prison was when I would do my laundry. I would put both hands in the washer and splash around like an idiot. And when I first came home, the first place we went to, 4th of July, I went to Lake Paris. And I did not care how green that water was. I got right in it and dove right in and did a flip in that water because I was so excited to be swimming again. I'm in San Diego today, and I never realized how beautiful San Diego was. I mean, there's people around sleeping, working out. I mean, the water is amazing. And I think what people maybe they don't really realize is just how beautiful it is when the sun hits that water. And you get to see it with your own eyes, because all you see in prison is a brick wall and people screaming and the guard's keys and a really bad smell. And that's what you see in prison. That's why we always get all those damn travel magazines. It's, you know, we put them up all over our cell because that's what we want to see. But even the smells, I think people forget really how beautiful life is when you get to smell, you know, the grass, the sage, the flowers, the seawater, a bonfire somewhere, fish being cooked, you know? I mean, there's just a whole, people don't realize it. I think people need to stop moving so fast and put down their cell phones and get away from the TV and really go sit somewhere outside. Take that time, you know? Because I mean, I think like this could happen to anybody. And I know Amanda Knox had said it before. She's like, but you know, I'm you. You could be me. Because it happens that quick. You know, wrongful convictions happen more than you know it. Hey.
This podcast was produced by me, Callum McRae. Please rate and leave feedback for us on iTunes or wherever you download your podcasts.